This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the forces that came close to defeating President Obama's secret trade treaty say the fight's not over yet. A cornerstone of civil rights law is upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Green Party campaigns on a Power to the People platform.
But first, the majority black city of Jackson, Mississippi, was one of three sites of the U.S. Social Forum this weekend. Kali Akuno is a longtime activist with the Malcolm X grassroots movement and a former aide to Chokwe Lumumba, the late mayor of Jackson, who saw global warming as a political priority.
Through the Malcolm X grassroots movement and cooperation in Jackson, climate change has been a key issue of ours, the key issue of the Jackson Kush campaign, which many folks know for Chokwe Lumumba being elected mayor and pursuing that office as a part of the strategy from that particular initiative. But one of our goals during his administration and remain is to make Jackson both a human rights city and a sustainable city. And we see those two things going hand in hand. And we know that people of African descent, black folks in the South in particular and throughout the world, we're going to be on the front line and already are on the front line of climate change. You see it here in the South with some of the crop changes that are taking place, how that affects many of our black farmers, people having to make adjustments, not getting support, being discriminated against historically by the USDA and other agencies. See it in the Caribbean with a great concentration of our people with a drought that's going on there. And you see it in Africa in a number of different ways. But probably its greatest expression is this latest wave of folks having to flee deteriorating economic conditions being caused by the increase of desertification, what they're doing to destroy the economy on the continent. So many folks are having to flee to Europe in search of some refuge, which you see them talking about responding to militarily, trying to create Fortress Europe, which we are very familiar with here with Fortress America, and how they treat us and try to legislate our folks from Haiti and other folks who have been trying to get here against repressive regimes set up by the United States government for decades. So it's not like for us this is kind of a Johnny-come-lately issue. Folks should know that this is something that's been on our radar for quite some time.
Yes, black folks in the United States have historically been treated as commodities, as a chattel to be used and then used up, and our communities are treated in the similar fashion today.
That's right. That's right. I mean, Jackson, a particularly significant portions of it, are still very much viewed that way, treated that way by the local and international ruling forces as a dump site, as a place where you can kind of take money away from by charging higher rents, charging higher fees for goods and services than you would charge in other areas that just deplete and take resources out of the community and don't put anything back. And meanwhile, a place like Jackson, you know, it's the largest city in Mississippi, therefore has the largest tax base, even though it has a high concentration of folks who have been strategically impoverished. But it still subsidizes the growth and the economy of the surrounding suburbs, which are predominantly white. So this is part of this larger dynamic of super exploitation and resource extraction that our people are suffering with, and which we're trying to combat the overall campaign, the strategy of which the Social Forum was just one point of mobilization and one point of education to do.
And let me shift just a little bit. You were one of the co-authors of Operation Ghetto Storm, which tried to tabulate police murders of black folks in the United States. And you issued that report that documented one such killing every 28 hours. Now the Washington Post and the Guardian newspaper and other institutions with lots of resources are doing their own tallies.
Yeah, which is, from my vantage point, misses the point. We did that to highlight a phenomenon that really only a few, I think, forces in the black left and the black, you know, resident community were paying any systematic kind of attention to. And we wanted to really highlight, first and foremost, to our own people, that when you look at this comprehensively, you've got to come to an assessment that we are being hunted. We are being killed in cold blood, and it's not without a purpose. It's not random. It's systemic, and it's basically population control and disposal of, to the system at least, to a population which is becoming unwanted and unnecessary for economic production in the society. And they're basically developing, you know, some plans that we've seen since Katrina, I would argue, of trying to find methods by which to dispose of us, which are politically acceptable. So there's a larger piece than just counting that I think we have to be aware of. And for my part, you know, I'm very proud of that work. And I think the contribution it has made towards this latest upsurge of Black resistance. But I really would want folks to highlight on the analysis and the politics and program that we were trying to push from that report, from that work, not just the statistic and the hashtag, which doesn't take us towards, you know, well, what is the solution? What is the program of liberation? That is what I would argue that folks should start focusing on now, while there is this energy, while there is this upsurge, while there are young people beginning to become politically conscious and engaged in fighting back. There's a program that needs to be put in place that I don't see fully manifesting yet, you know, even though this moment is, I think, is still emerging and developing. But we have to be clear on what are our aims and objectives and how we're going to achieve them. And The Guardian, The Washington Post, despite their criticism of our earlier work, you know, now taking on Become It's Popular, they're not going to do that. We know that they're going to do that. And quite frankly, that's not their role. So our organizations, our forces, we have to kind of get our act together, sharpen up our politics, and move on it. Organize our community so that we can defend ourselves against what we know is going to be an increasing number of attacks and strike back with the program that's going to liberate us. You know, that's the hard work that really needs to be done. Counting was just a prelude, I think, to that type of work.
And so we find ourselves today with an emerging or incipient movement that does not yet have clarity of mission.
That's right. That's right. You know, I know that there's an effort to kind of come to some clarity with this meeting in Cleveland that's being planned. I think it's called the Conference for Black Lives or the Movement for Black Lives. I would push that rather than just declaring that Black Lives matter, we have to get, I think, real clarity on, you know, what do Black people need to be liberated, which is a different question, which focuses you to aim your energy in a different way. And we need to start looking at what is going to get us to be a self-determined people. It's basically the prelude to being socially and materially liberated. And there's a number of different things that I think this movement is going to have to contend with. You know, one, going to have to contend with all this energy, attempts of all this energy being diverted and rerouted into narrow kind of reformist paths, which will lead nowhere, as we ultimately know. We need to make sure and struggle with a lot of the folks who are engaging this motion that they don't divert our folks into supporting the misleadership class in the Democratic Party that has tried to channel and contain Black organizing energy and Black rage for generations, and which is on the move and trying to inch its way in, if not buy its way into this conference and other initiatives. So these are things a few of us who have got a little bit more seasoning, we have to find ways to effectively communicate it to a lot of the younger generation so they can at least avoid some of the mistakes that we made and learn from them and press this struggle one step further.
That was Kali Akuno of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement in Jackson, Mississippi.
Minister Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam spoke recently at Washington, D.C.'s Metropolitan AME Church. Farrakhan says Black folks are mad at the wrong flag.
White folks march with you because they don't want you upsetting the city. They don't give a damn about them nine. When they arrested that skunk, you know, a skunk is a heck of an animal, you know. Even after it's dead, its funk keeps on going. When they arrested him, they took him to the Burger King. I'll be damned. Man, just killed nine human beings. And you know what they were saying? You did a good job killing all them. You think they were sympathetic? If they were sympathetic with us, they'd have snatched him, put him in chains, had the gun on him. I don't know what the hell the fight is about over the Confederate flag. We need to put the American flag down because we've cut as much hell under that as the Confederate flag. Who are we fighting today? It's the people that carry the American flag. What flag do the police have? What flag flies over the non-justice department? What flag flies over the White House, where a black man lives that's called every day? What about that flag? So every time we die, they give us a symbol, no substance. We died on Edmund Pettus Bridge under that flag. Under that flag. We fought in wars under that flag. And came back and were hung and murdered and brutalized under that flag. So don't give us no symbol. Well, now we're going to pull the flag down. That's as easy as it is pulling your pants down. You got to answer a call to nature, you pull your pants down. That's easy. Pull a flag down and you supposed to go away satisfied? See, you don't know what justice looks like. If somebody can pull a flag down and you're happy as though they did something. We want justice under that flag, or what the hell is the use of us paying allegiance to a flag under which we get no justice?
Minister Louis Farrakhan at Washington's Metropolitan AME Church.
President Obama won the right to fast-track his secret trade treaty, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, through the Congress recently. But opponents will have another chance to stop the TPP in the fall. Kevin Zies is with Popular Resistance. He says the fight isn't over yet.
Oh, definitely not. This is the end of this round. It would have been better if they had not provided Obama this power to fast-track these trade agreements, but we still can fight each trade agreement. The next battle will be over the Trans-Pacific Partnership itself. It will come in the fall. We don't know exactly when yet. We'll get a sense of that in the next couple months. But we're gearing up for that battle. There's a lot of anger in response to what people see as clear corruption. Corruption that was very choreographed. It's choreographed because they got exactly 218 votes in the House, which is the majority number, 218. They got exactly 60 votes in the Senate, which is the majority number. Not one vote over in each chamber. Nancy Pelosi did her job of fooling progressives into thinking she was on their side, and in fact really helping President Obama get the exact number of votes he needed, 218 in the House. That was the critical vote, and we know her failure because when the vote was going into the House, there were only about 20 Democrats who supported it. When the vote actually happened, there were 28, the exact number needed. And when the vote was revoted, not one of those 28 changed. A real leader who opposed Fast Track certainly could have changed a handful of those votes and denied President Obama this power. But she was always on Obama's side, and so she gave him what he needed. And so we saw the choreographed corruption, and people are very angry about it. People are ready for a revolt.
And so we're looking for an up or down vote in the fall.
The whole treaty will come up, and there are three treaties. The first one is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The second one is the transatlantic version with Europe. And the third one, which I think is the most damaging, includes 50 nations, and it's the Trade and Services Agreement. services cover 80% of the U.S. economy, everything from accounting services to postal services to education and health services or financial services. So it's 80% of the U.S. economy. That's the most dangerous. The Congress will be blowing each of those three treaties, if they complete the negotiations, individually. And the first to come up will be the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It'll come up as one large document. One thing that we won in the fast-track effort was an additional 60 days to supposedly see the treaty. And before the fast-track process starts, the clock starts running on that. So we have 60 days to educate and organize people and mobilize them. We really need to mobilize people. We need to see another Battle of Seattle. We need to see another Miami trade fight. We need to see some real anger in the streets. There was a populist rebellion before these votes, before these choreographed votes, where hundreds of thousands of people every week were calling the Senate and the House, probably more than a million calls in the last 3 weeks. So there's a lot of mobilization on the phones. And that was ignored. And that's why they limited their vote to the exact majority, because they didn't want to put other political careers at risk. They knew the public was angry. They knew the Democratic base did not support this. And so they just had the bare number supported so that they could get the votes they needed. So we saw that insecurity on that part. Now we have to be more angry. We have to show a visceral anger. The great thing about this, it would be in an election year. That will mean that elected officials will be even more nervous, more afraid of the voters, especially the voters show that kind of anger. It means we could get this into the presidential debates and make this a national issue. There's disagreements among Republicans as well as Democrats about these trade agreements. The Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton types support them, although try to hide it. And there are the grassroots types, like Bernie Sanders, and on the right, people like Ted Cruz, who actually oppose it. And so it's going to be very interesting to see that debate unfold. There's an opportunity for us to boomerang this fast-track vote into a national debate on whether rigged corporate trade that puts the profits of ultra-mega transnational corporations ahead of the needs of the people and the protection of the planet. So it's a great opportunity for a very big debate that could really undermine these corporate trade agreements for a very long time.
So is the whole country going to get to see the whole of this treaty? Previously, congresspersons could look at parts of it, but couldn't even take notes.
That's right, and that's still true. In fact, what happens is the Congress goes down to a little room in Congress, and then the Congress member is there with a U.S. Trade Representative staff person overlooking, watching them over their shoulder. They can't bring paper, pen, computer, telephone, camera, anything to record what's in it. And they're warned that if they say what's in it, they're faced with criminal charges. What they get to see is only one of the three trade agreements, the TPP. And with the TPP, they mostly get summaries and a lot of blacked out sections. So even when they go through all that rigmarole, they still can't see the treaty in full. Under the fast-track agreement, under the law that just passed, it says that for 60 days, Congress will get a copy of the treaty, full treaty, to be seen, and so that people know what they're voting on. Now, whether that means that the public will get to see it is not yet really clear. Whether that full treaty will be the blacked-out summary type that they get to see now, that would not be what the law meant, but that may be what they end up doing. So we may have a fight about with that, what people can see there. But I think this lack of transparency issue is going to be one that backfires against them. We've had enough weeks now that we know what's in these treaties. We know the direction they're going, and it's all toward corporate power, loss of sovereignty for people and nations and local and state governments. We know that's the direction they're going. And so even if they keep it secret, we have a lot of ammunition to fight this with. And if the failure to make it public will provide more ammunition. So we're going to fight for as much transparency as we can get.
One would think that at least one congressman would reveal the treaty quite publicly and dare the administration to arrest him or her.
That would be a great step. And the one who came closest to that in this previous round was Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, not someone I'm usually in political agreement with. He went down and read the agreement, then he wrote a 7-page letter highlighting some of the key points that he read about, and he sent it to all of the senators of both parties. That got reported in the media by Breitbart. They must have seen the letter, and they quoted large parts of it. And so that was the closest we came to a senator doing that. You know, the problem is that the senators don't get to keep a copy, or the congress members don't get to keep a copy of what they see in that basement room. So they had to come back and, from their memory, write a summary. So that's one of the challenges. It's not like Daniel Ellsberg can leak the, no one's leaked the text to a senator so that can be read on the Senate floor. It happened with the Pentagon Papers. No one has leaked the full text. We've had sections leaked. And, you know, reading that on the full Senate floor is going to be, it's a 1,000-plus page document, so that's not going to be a fun reading, a listening assignment for the American people if they do it. But I think the Jeff Sessions approach is a great approach, and I think more members of Congress should do that. Go see the treaty, come back and write about it. You could take a half dozen senators, divide up the sections of the treaty each one can focus on. They can all write about that section and spread the word about what's really in this thing. That would be a truly patriotic thing to do, is to let the American public know what this secret law that they're trying to pass is all about. And I think they could get away with that without getting arrested. There's a lot of congressional privilege as far as speaking on the floor, and I think speaking to your colleagues. And hey, who knows who leaked it, right, from that your dear colleague letter. So I don't think it'd be very easy to prosecute, although I'd love to see them try. But I want to see members of the Congress use their political power, their political position, to read the text and report to us what's in it.
With President Obama only getting 28 Democratic votes in the House, only 3 from the Congressional Black Caucus, he looked to be a Republican president, leading a Republican legislature to victory.
Well, that is definitely what the Democratic Party wants you to think. And there's no question this trade agreement and Obama's actions are much more consistent with the Republican ideology. And, of course, Clinton was a big supporter of these same kind of trade agreements, so it's not purely Republican ideology. But I think the reality is that both parties support this type of approach. The reason why you saw Republicans support this is because their base is more built on pro-business, less regulation type of philosophy. So their base is more likely to support these rigged trade agreements. On the Democrat side, their base is more likely to oppose it. You know, that's a base of workers, of unions, of more progressive folks who don't believe in business being dominant the way that the Republican base does. And so they have to be more careful in their support. So the Democrats played the role of providing just enough votes to make this bipartisan and to make this a majority. You don't get to 218, the exact number, in the House by accident. FDR said that nothing in politics happens by accident. If it happened, it was planned. So getting to 218 was not a coincidence. It was not an accident. It was choreographed. It was planned. And Nancy Pelosi is the leader of the party, and she's responsible for that. It was a way for the Democrats to make their base think this was the Republicans doing it. But in fact, this was a bipartisan effort by the leadership of both parties and by President Obama to push forward a corporate agenda, a big business agenda, to put the profits of these mega transnational corporations ahead of the necessities of the people who are struggling, who are not making enough to survive on, who can't pay for their health care, you know, who can't afford to send their kids to college. Put those interests aside and put the interests of the planet that's at a tipping point of climate change and so many environmental disasters. Put those aside and put the profits of their big donors first. This is one that's going to change the whole direction of the country. Yeah. The Trade and Services Agreement is probably going to privatize the Postal Service in the end. And the Postal Service is the second largest employer in the country. It's the largest employer of African Americans, largest employer of veterans. And if that gets privatized, there'll be a lot of lost jobs, a lot of solid jobs being lost. It's going to destroy what's left of the middle class, especially in African American communities. It's going to be devastating. So that's just one example of many of how these Trade and Services Agreement and the other agreements are going to impact the reality of life in the United States. It's going to be a transformation that we don't want to see.
Yes, it seems that there is no area of economic life that it does not touch.
That's exactly right. Our food will be less safe. Our water will be more privatized. We're going to see a Trade and Services Agreement. Not only is it 50 countries, but 80% of our economy is a services economy. So the Postal Service, the education services, the financial services, accounting services. You know, you think that we lost industry thanks to NAFTA, you know, just to a couple of countries and then a few other, you know, bilateral trade agreements. But what we're going to lose now with this Trade and Services Agreement is 80% of our economy is services. Accountants who do all our taxes, forget it. They'll be done in India. Or they'll be done in Vietnam or Malaysia. It's going to force all of our services workers to compete with slave labor in Malaysia, where one-third of those who work in the electronics field in Malaysia are slaves, literally. They are indentured servants, who migrants who came to the country and now are slaves. In Vietnam, it's 50 cents is about the average income of an hourly worker in Vietnam. And U.S. workers are going to compete with that. Our accountants are going to compete with that. Our health services are going to compete with that. Our financial service sector, you're going to see even those jobs are going to be moving out of the country. So it's going to be a really interesting transformation that's going to be devastating to our economy. And this is President Obama's legacy. You know, when I saw that fast track pass, there's a picture of Joe Biden and President Obama arm in arm watching C-SPAN together. And I was thinking, well, they must be thinking their future is made. President Obama will get the $500 million he needs for his three presidential centers in Chicago, Hawaii, and New York. That's not coming from the $25 contributors. That's coming from the people who just won Fast Track. We just won Fast Track 4. It's a great investment for them to put hundreds of millions of dollars into this because they're going to get trillions of dollars in return. And President Obama and Joe Biden, their lives financially are made after they leave office.
That was Kevin Zees of Popular Resistance.
In a 5-4 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court last week ruled that the Fair Housing Act of 1968 remains constitutional. ACLU lawyer Dennis Parker was on the winning side in the case. At issue was the principle that the existence of racial disparities in outcomes is sufficient to prove racial discrimination. Attorney Parker says that principle is a cornerstone of civil rights law.
It really is. What it does is it gives formal recognition by the Supreme Court. I mean, this has been the law in the United States for decades. Every court of appeals that has heard the case about whether disparate impact could create a cause of action under the Fair Housing Act has agreed that it can. The federal agencies that enforce the Fair Housing Act have relied and have issued regulations that create disparate impact. So this is basically the Supreme Court giving a nod of approval to what has been the law for a long time. But it's important, as you say, particularly for dealing with questions of institutional or structural racism, because it doesn't require that you need to show an intent to discriminate in order to make it possible for someone to go into court.
And that's precisely why the right has fought against that principle for so many years.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a sign of its importance as a legal principle, the resistance that there's been to it. And I think at some level, it's really just a common sense approach to enforcing fairness, but permitting business and other things to operate in a way that is fair to them, too. And what it's saying is, if you have a policy, if you have a practice that has a disparate impact on a protected class of people, then you should have to make sure that there's a reason for it and that it's the only way you can achieve that goal. And what it looks at is consequences. You know, if you're the victim of discrimination, it would be extremely frustrating to be hurt by a policy and then have no recourse because you couldn't show what was in someone's mind when they put the policy into effect. So it is really a cornerstone of enforcement, and I think it's a clear recognition of the form that discrimination takes predominantly. I mean, obviously, and we're reminded of this daily, there are people who engage in intentional discrimination. But it's not like in the 50s where you have state laws that, you know, say you have to go to separate schools or, you know, you can't sit at the drugstore counter. Now you have a complicated system of things that have the same impact in terms of denying people opportunity, but are far more subtle and far more nuanced. This gives you a way to deal with that.
Yes, and some of those perpetrators are huge institutions, like, for example, Countrywide Finance, now owned by the Bank of America, which had to come to a settlement because of its subprime mortgage policies and how they impacted on black and brown folks.
And that's a perfect example of the kind of policy that has an enormous impact and that you want to be able to have people get some sort of redress in the courts if they're the victims of that. We actually requested that the SSRC do a report that tries to take a look at the future impact of the economic crisis of 2007 and 2008. And what it shows is not only were black people disproportionately hurt by the recession, that they are recovering far more slowly, and that the impact will continue to be felt in the future by them as they get older and by their children. So this is an important thing. You're talking about whether you have access to full civil life in the United States. It goes to whether or not you can build up wealth, not only to change your life, but to change the life of the people who come after you.
I suppose we're really talking about the social compact, whether society in the form of the state has a responsibility to remedy those who've been harmed.
Yes, and I think particularly since many of the harms have their roots in government action. So even if they are not the immediate parties who are responsible for the policies, if you look at federal housing policy in the 40s and 50s, it shaped the housing segregation. It shaped the fact that equity in home ownership for black people was not the same as for whites. It played a definite role. And I think that, you know, it's an example of how federal law can protect people who are unprotected, who are most vulnerable.
And in fact, we couldn't be talking about reparations in any legal sense without this principle, could we?
No, because the immediate answer would be, well, you know, the people who were responsible for slavery have been long dead. But in fact, again, the conditions now have their roots in what happened in the past, number one. And number two, that people are still enjoying the benefits, even if they are not themselves slaveholders. That the truth is that there continues to be privileges that are attached to being white.
Were lawyers like yourself holding your breath, awaiting this ruling?
We were. We would sit in front of the computers waiting for the decision to come down. And the reason that we were very apprehensive is, as I said, this has been the law for a long time. Literally every single court of appeals in the country that decided this held that disparate impact was intended by Congress and is the appropriate standard. Congress itself resisted efforts to try to strip disparate impact out of the law. And so when the Supreme Court seemed very interested in taking it, it raised a lot of questions. You know, normally one of the issues the Supreme Court takes into consideration is whether there's a disagreement in the circuit courts. But here there was no disagreement. As I said, this was something that was in place for a long time. And so people were saying, well, why are they so intent on reviewing this? And this is the third case that raised the question. The two prior ones got to the Supreme Court and then were settled at the 11th hour. And so when they took it for a third time, a lot of people were saying the only thing that would explain this is they must want to disembowel the law, basically. So we were afraid, if not of the worst, than at least of bad things.
And it was a 5-4 decision, so you, I guess, concluded that those four were intent on doing something to that principle.
I think that's right, yes. And I think that many, many decisions, such as the marriage equality decision, end up coming down to a 5-4 vote. And I think that it's pretty clear who are the more liberal and who are the more conservative judges, and it's just a question of whether one justice will join one camp or the other to make it a majority. But 5-4 is a clear majority, and I'm hoping that it puts this question to rest.
Attorney Dennis Parker for the ACLU in New York.
Jill Stein last week formally announced her candidacy for President of the United States under the Green Party banner for the second time. Stein is running on a Power to the People platform.
It's a plan to address the crisis of justice and democracy that our country and our time represent. And it has echoes of the Black Panthers in it, and that's not by coincidence. And, you know, we take that as inspiration for what we must do. And I think it recognizes that power is inseparable from the solutions. So this isn't just about a bunch of solutions. It's about we the people taking power, which we have never had really in this country. It's about moving forward this promise of democracy and, you know, breaking the stranglehold of corporations, of corporate capitalism, of racism, and the incredible burdens that we have been laboring under in this country, and lifting up the vision and the real work that's been done at the level of the communities. And I'll say that our campaign is founded on the idea that the struggles of frontline communities should be in the front line of presidential dialogue. We should not be a footnote in that dialogue. We should not be excluded from that dialogue. The struggles of Black Lives Matter, of young people in debt, of working people who have been thrust into low-wage, temporary, and part-time jobs as the real defining feature of this so-called recovery, which is not a recovery, it's an emergency. That is not sufficient. We need a real comprehensive solution that moves us forward, and this is not rocket science. We can do this, and it is inseparable from the issue of power. And that is why we talk about a power to the people plan.
One element of your platform calls for an expansion of what people call entitlement, Medicaid, Social Security. This president, the current one, came into office calling for all the entitlements to be put on the table for chopping. If Hillary Clinton wins office, and she comes from the same wing of the Democratic Party as President Obama, is there any reason to expect that she won't do the same?
Well, as Hillary herself said some months ago, she was hiring 100 public relations agents so that she could provide a message more supportive of economic justice. So she is tailoring her message, but we would be fools to go around the block again, as we did with Barack Obama in his second administration, where he changed his tune in time for the election and put behind him these calls for the grand bargain, which would cut Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid. He put behind him his track record and said, listen to what I say, not what I do. And that lesson needs to be very much looked at, remembered right now as they try to lull us back to sleep to go to the polls and bring on more of the same. I think it's very important that we not continue to vote for these parties of power and privilege, but instead stand up and actually build power for people on the planet. And that's what we are doing inside the Green Party as an independent third party, the only national party that is not poisoned by corporate money.
Well, Bernie Sanders certainly doesn't send the same message, at least, as Hillary Clinton, but he's promised that if he doesn't win, he'll endorse her. Is a vote for Bernie Sanders actually, in the end, a vote for Hillary and the Democratic Party?
I think it would be hard to argue otherwise. Bernie has made very clear that at the end of the day, he will endorse Hillary, and I mean, he has already basically given his pledge of allegiance to endorse Hillary or any other corporate Democrat that will win the process, the very corporate money-dominated process by which the Democrats will select their nominee. So while we have some similarities with Bernie, we have the liberty to actually do what must be done for our survival. And that is, you know, that we need not only jobs, we need full employment and at living wages. We need not only to make public higher education free, we need to cancel student debt, to abolish student debt. We bailed out the bankers who created this economic crisis. The least we can do is bail out the students who are among the key victims, an entire generation, which is essentially indentured servants without relief in sight, given that the jobs being created now, 75%, are low-wage, temporary, part-time. And we have bipartisan agreement that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is the economic development program of the future. That is, it will develop the economy further for the 1% and continue to crush the rest of us. So there are some similarities with Bernie, but we represent very different parties. I will also say we have different approaches on the human rights for Palestine, on the military, and on creating a foreign policy based on human rights, international law, and diplomacy rather than on military brute strength, which has proven to be the disaster that it actually is over the last 15 years. So those are some of the differences. But at the end of the day, our campaign is going to be there for the long haul, whether it's us or some other Green Party. You know, that will be determined by the party. But I will say we are the one declared national campaign for the Greens at this point, and our policies are shared by the party as opposed to oppressed by the party. So at the end of the day, come November, we will be there for the long haul, and we don't stop in November. This is about building a base that is of, by, and for the people and not the corporations. When Bernie pledges allegiance to Hillary Clinton or other corporate candidates, his campaign resources and apparatus will be basically absorbed back into a party that is hostile to the vision that he may support. At the end of the day, it will be disappeared while the party continues to march to the right. Bernie has predecessors, including Jesse Jackson, who had perhaps the most strongest, most vigorous reform campaign from inside the Democratic Party, but it disappeared without a trace. Same for, you know, Al Sharpton and Dennis Kucinich. You know, they have their moment, and then they're gone, while the Democratic Party continues to move to the right. So I think it's a really great time for people who really understand what an emergency we are in for the economy, for racial justice, for foreign policy, and for the climate, that we don't have time to fiddle around on the margins here. We really need to be building and building a solution that doesn't disappear, that builds and continues to build, because the clock is ticking. We need to cast aside this politics of fear, this lesser evil, for the greater good. If we don't stand up for it, they are certainly not going to do us a favor. So it's time to be talked out of our power. We have the power of our solutions, of our program. We have the power of our numbers. Add together 1 in 2 Americans in poverty and low income, the 1 in 3 African American men held hostage by the prison state, 40 million students who are in debt. This is more than a plurality. This is a majority of the American public that is hurting for change on behalf of people, planet, and peace over profit. This is the time to stand up. There will be no other time, and there won't be a whole lot of opportunities going forward into the future. So this is time to take ourselves seriously and cast off the veil of fear that's been holding us back. Time to break the stranglehold and move forward with the future that is actually in our hands.
One of the baselines is that the Green Party wants to do well enough that it secures at least a permanent place on the ballot instead of having to scramble every 4 years to get a place on the ballot.
And it will take some work. The way the system works right now is that we need to scramble to get on the ballot. And that's why we cannot stop after one election. We need to make good on that cycle of being on the ballot. We need to make good on this surge towards democracy in this election. We cannot run alone. We need to run with as many empowered people at the level of our community to be fighting for office at all levels of public office, including local, state, Congress, etc. We need to get as much out of that ballot access as we possibly can. And we are very fortunate to have Bruce Dixon leading the charge and helping to design this plan for our mobilization around democracy and empowerment through representation on the ballot.
You spoke of human rights and foreign policy. President Obama and his former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, would claim that human rights is the center of their foreign policy as well, and it takes the form of humanitarian, so-called, military intervention.
That's right. Military intervention on behalf of the warlords who've been recruited to their cause, who have been bought and paid for, in order to secure our total military and economic domination. No one would pretend that human rights are prevailing in Egypt or Saudi Arabia or in Israel, for that matter, although Obama and other Democrats, Clinton and Bernie Sanders, for that matter, would make that case. but I think it's very clear, the United Nations has been on record, there is no way that the war on Gaza can be characterized really as anything other than a war crime, a massive violation of human rights, the outright slaughter of civilians, largely by the thousands, an incredible, disproportionate, and massive show of force, which in itself is a human rights violation. You know, all of 44 Israelis have been killed, and that is a regrettable thing over the past decade, but the numbers are, you know, more like 4,000 Palestinians who have been slaughtered in the two recent wars on civilians. So it's very clear that we should not be funding these wars. We should not be in the business of funding governments like the Netanyahu government, to whom we pay now $8 million a day to support their massive military. So this is a problem that is unacceptable and represents a massive violation of human rights. We need a foreign policy founded on human rights, international law, and diplomacy. That is the place from which we can move forward. It's clear that a foreign policy based on a massive show of force has been a massive, colossal failure. The violence only increases. The instability only grows. In Iraq, for example, now, the current government cannot even find the Iraqis. They are nowhere to be found. The Iraqis who are willing to even be trained, as if they could be trained now and they couldn't be trained on behalf of a U.S. agenda over the past decade. Why are they suddenly going to be converted to that U.S. basically oil securing, oil and market securing agenda? Now they're not. We need to go back to the drawing boards, and we need an agenda based on human rights, not on the procurement of oil and markets.
If the United States has no serious nation state enemies, what's a defense budget for, and how big should the cuts be?
Exactly. That is one of the things we're calling for, a defense budget, which is a defense budget and not an offense budget. When you have 700 bases around the world, you know, in areas where we have no business being, it's hard to say that this is anything other than an exercise in empire and securing markets. So let's start with 50% and go from there. I think we need to cut this offense budget, which is a liability. It does not make us more secure. It makes us less secure.
Jill Stein, presidential candidate for the Green Party.
This year marks the 90th birthday of two giants of the African diaspora. Maurice Carney of Friends of the Congo explains from Washington.
July 2nd of this year represents the 90th birthday of Congolese independence hero and first democratically elected Prime Minister Patrice Emery Lumumba. So just as earlier this year in May, we commemorated Malcolm X and his 90th birthday. We'll be commemorating Patrice Emery Lumumba, who would have been 90 on July 2nd of this year, 2015.
So what's the political importance of the confluence of these two dates?
Yes, actually, to a large extent, with Malcolm, who introduced Patrice Lumumba to a new generation. After Lumumba was assassinated on January 17th, 1961, the complicity of the United States and the CIA, the Belgian government, and the United Nations, Malcolm spoke most eloquently about the role that the United States had played in deposing Lumumba, which led to his assassination. And he said that Lumumba was the greatest African to ever walk the continent. And he said that because he respected in Patrice Lumumba the fact that he stood on his own terms. He said that they couldn't reach him, they meaning the U.S. and the West, in trying to corrupt and co-opt Lumumba. He said Lumumba stood on principles that went far beyond any desire for monetary gain or for excessive accumulation of power that we've seen so many African leaders today. So for this reason that Lumumba was respected by Malcolm, and Malcolm said he was the greatest African to ever walk the continent.
And of course, Patrice Lumumba is not just an icon in Africa and specifically the Congo today, but he inspires current political movements.
Oh, absolutely. Today we have young Congolese, in particular, and young Africans, especially those in the hip-hop community who are making songs about Lumumba, about his teachings, about his ideas, about his vision for a strong Congo, but also, equally important, a unified Africa. So we have a new generation of young activists and young musicians in the Congo and throughout the continent who are articulating the ideas, the teachings, the vision of Patrice Lumumba through their music, through the art. We have painters who are painting images and murals of Lumumba. So there is a reconnecting that is taking place among young Africans with their previous independence heroes and freedom fighters. We see the same thing taking place in Burkina Faso and how the youth in Burkina Faso tapped into the ideas and the teachings of Thomas Sankara in influencing and inspiring the movement that they led at the end of last year to remove the assassin of Sankara, Blaise Compaoré. So we see this happening on the African continent, and it's really a corollary to some extent here where we see figures like Kwame Ture being uplifted, and of course Malcolm X himself is being tapped into by the younger generation and looking back and see what he did in the 60s to contribute to African liberation. Ella Baker, we see the Black Lives Matter movement, youth tapping into the ideas of Ella Baker and even Assata Shakur, people who have come before. And of course, Assata is still living in Cuba, but her life, her zest and zeal for African liberation, we find that both on the continent and here in the United States, we have young people of African ancestry who are drawing inspiration from those who have come before them in their fight for freedom and liberation.
So young people in the diaspora are making the connection, connecting the historical and political dots.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, the youth in Ferguson, for example, are Hands Up United. One, they have a study group. And one of the figures that they're studying for this month is actually Patrice Lumumba. And in studying Lumumba, they're not only looking at him as a historical figure, but they're reaching out to young Congolese and engaging young Congolese and having young Congolese articulate to them what does Lumumba mean to them as they fight their struggle. So we see this, although it's in its embryonic stages, the attempt to connect movements, you know, from Ferguson to Congo, from the U.S. to Africa. And if these youth are successful in making those connections, it only strengthens their movement and make their quest for liberation even more assured. There'd be a stronger foundation for them. Well, put it this way, Graham. If Dylan Roof can call on the anti-apartheid state and former Rhodesia for inspiration to do evil acts as he did in South Carolina, how much more powerful would it be for our youth here to call on, you know, the African liberation heroes and those who stood up on the continent for freedom and liberation? So it's not only those who are working to oppress us that can function on a global scale. We too can function on a global scale. Our fight is not just local, it's not just national, but it's global in scope. And that's what these young people are realizing and are tapping into for inspiration for their new movement in the 21st century.
And what are Friends of Congo doing on July 2nd to mark the occasion?
Well, we're commemorating Lumumba. We're screening a film and hosting a teach-in to introduce Lumumba to those who are not fully familiar with his teachings and his ideas and his aspirations for the African continent, for African people. So we'll be doing that here in Washington, D.C., actually the day before on July 1st, we'll be having a commemoration. And should people like to get more information and participate, they can visit our website at friendsofthecongo.org. That's friendsofthecongo.org. And we encourage people, Glenn, to uplift Lumumba on Thursday, July 2nd by tweeting his speeches, tweeting his words. And they can all tag us at Congo Friends on Twitter, as we'll be spending the entire day letting people, letting the world know about who Lumumba was, why he's important to the African world, and the value of his words and his ideas for a new generation.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.